Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, saṅghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dutiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dutiyampi saṅghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, tatiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, tatiyampi saṅghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. So welcome everybody to Friday night meditation. Here we are, another Friday night. And this has been a kind of interesting week for me in a couple ways. One way was we had this children's meditation program here on Sunday, and I'd never taught children meditation before. So it was an interesting experience. Some of them were, you know, maybe like three. And then some were, you know, seven. And then some were like 14. So there was quite a range, but they were all kind of really well behaved and sat down and meditated for an entire half hour. I think you guys were there, right? Yeah, I was gonna get you guys to try to sit at the front so that you could model. So if it happens again, then maybe you can be our experts in the kids' class. But this is one of the things, that was one thing that was interesting that happened. And then the other thing is I've had these continuing adventures on Facebook. You know, so I think I was telling everybody before that I've never been an active Facebook user, even before it started. And so it's been, I think, 2 weeks now that I've been using Facebook. And it's been an interesting experience, because I don't really know how it works. So before everybody came in, I was telling Alicia and Dushan that basically whoever wanted to be my friend, I just added them. And so now I have 2,600 friends on Facebook. But then the funny thing that happened was Facebook started thinking I was a spammer. So they blocked my ability to accept new friends. So I can no longer accept new friend requests for the time being, which I think is temporary. And I didn't know that rule. So it's kind of going along doing my thing in Facebook. And then I found out there's these ways you can, you know, not use it right. You know? Not use Facebook in the proper way. And so, of course, this is something kind of funny, because I imagine for our young friends here or for other people who are using Facebook since it first came out, they have a kind of idea of how to use Facebook. And when they get on there, it's no problem clicking all the buttons and moving things around and accepting friends the right way, making posts the right way, setting your post to public in the right way. But for me, even though I'm of the generation that should know how to use Facebook, I actually don't really have a clue. So I accepted all these friends, and then sometimes some of them would send me weird messages. And so then I unfriended them. In other words, there's a kind of learning curve, even to something like Facebook, if you've never done it. Even if you should know how. Yeah. And so this is something that's true not only of Facebook, but actually of every skill that we want to learn. You know, everything that we want to do has its kind of rules to it. Some of those rules are rules that we'll learn right when we come into a situation. People will tell us, you know, okay, do X, don't do Y. Do Z, don't do W. And so we have a good idea of the rules that are governing that situation, good idea of how to act in it. But then there's also these other rules that people don't tell us, other parts of the game whatever situation we're playing, whatever skill we're trying to learn, that nobody teaches us, that are just unspoken, and that we have to learn ourselves. So in this case, nobody told me that you could go into Facebook jail, which is what I found out it's called online. It's called like Facebook jail. They have like a Facebook sheriff, and if you don't behave properly, he throws you in jail and limits your freedom on Facebook. So I'm in Facebook jail a little bit right now. But I didn't know, officer. Nobody told me. But this is just the way it is. You know, go about trying to learn a new skill, and you obviously end up making some mistakes along the way. And sometimes you get kind of thrown in jail, you know, for your mistakes. So apparently this lasts for 30 days where I can't choose any new friends. But there are other things that we do. We don't have an idea of the duration of the mistake we made, how long it's going to last. And we go into a situation with the best intentions, trying to learn a new skill, trying to develop in a wholesome way, trying to do something good. And we come into that situation, we don't know the rules, and doing our best, we make a mistake. Now, in the West, there's sometimes this tendency around mistakes. We all learn as very young children that mistakes are actually our teacher, because without making mistakes, we don't learn the parameters, what's appropriate and inappropriate. If we don't try to do things, you know, if we don't make it, if we're too afraid to try things, we're too afraid to make mistakes, then we never develop in a new skill. But the West also has this other aspect to its culture. When I was there's this one monk who I really respect, and he was telling about this study they did in Japan. When the U.S. took over Japan in World War II, they wanted to know, or invaded Japan at the end of World War II, they wanted to know if the Japanese people would accept the U.S. occupation. So they hired a really kind of famous, maybe sociologist, maybe famous anthropologist. And she did a study. And what she came up with is that there was a difference in the culture between Japan and the West. And so the West at that time was what they had called a guilt culture. In other words, when little kids do something wrong, their parents say, "Don't do that because it hurts me. That doesn't make me feel good. You're hurting me." And in Japan, they have what's called a shame culture. So in other words, the parents would say, "Don't do that because you make us look bad in front of the neighbors." And so the U.S. was able to use this knowledge to make their occupation of Japan acceptable to people. But the interesting thing is that in the West, we do in some ways have this culture of guilt, kind of culture of feeling bad about ourselves, not liking ourselves. And this happens when we make mistakes. This feeling, "Oh, geez, why did I make this mistake?" can come up. Actually, there was this person who I was staying with when I first came back to the Toronto area. I was living with him for a while and just doing my monastic thing there. And I remember after living at a monastery for a long time, was not used to this kind of guilt culture. It's a different culture to a certain extent in a monastery. Not that everybody's perfect or anything, it's just a different culture. And when I was staying with him, I noticed that whenever he would make a mistake, he would go like this, "Stupid." He would like hit himself. And I was shocked when I first saw it. This kind of act of self-harm, self-hatred. But this can sometimes be our attitude towards mistakes when we're learning new skills, you know. If we don't do something to become number one, if we're not the best in our class, if we're not at the top of our game, you know, if people don't give us the praise right away, then something wrong with us, you know? Something we didn't do properly. Something to feel guilty about. But actually, when we come to sit down, excuse me, and train our minds in meditation, we have to adopt a different attitude. Not the attitude of shame either. But we have to adopt the attitude of the children that we hear outside playing right now. To a certain extent, when you see these little kids play and they run around and they, you know, fall and they scrape their knee, okay, they might cry a little bit, but you don't see them thinking they're a terrible person because of that. You don't see them thinking they're a bad person because of that. There's a kind of maybe intuitive knowledge at that age that when we're learning a new skill, we've got to play. We've got to test the boundaries. We've got to manipulate conditions a bit. And this is how we learn to be really good at something, through playing. And you notice these things with these little kids, the things that they play at, the things that they like, they play at them a lot. You know? I remember when I was a little kid and Super Mario first came out. So now there's there's one guy there. I don't know, is Super Mario still around? Yeah. Super Mario's still around. He's still, that makes him, you know, over 20 now, you know. But anyways, when Super Mario first came out, he was just made up of 5 or 6 little blocks. But I would go back to my house, and before I would sleep, I would dream about Super Mario. It was always on my mind. And then when I get home from school, I'd play Super Mario. And when I was at school, I'd be thinking about Super Mario. And guess what I got good at? Super Mario. And this is something similar with any skill that we want to learn. When we have the freedom, when we give ourselves this freedom, freedom from guilt, it's okay if our meditation isn't the best every time we sit down. We don't have to be fully with our breath 100% of the time. Today's meditation may not be the same as yesterday's, may not be the same as the day before's. But we can learn to become fascinated with the way that our minds work, because there is a pattern here. There are certain things that we can do to train our minds in a wholesome direction, and there are things that we can do to train our minds in an unwholesome direction. And the way that we learn about what those things are is through play. It's through trying them out. It's through making mistakes. So gradually, as we learn to do this, we learn to play with our meditation more, see how it reacts to certain situations. You know? If it's really hot in the room, there's this one skill that we learn, spreading feelings throughout our body. Where's a cool place in the body? Can we try to learn to spread that coolness through the rest of our body? And so for this, we need to change our attitudes a lot. Over the course of time in school, we learn about certain things that are possible and certain things that are impossible. Partially through this doctrine of materialism, that everything is material. There's no immaterial things. And so certain things seem impossible. Can I breathe through the back of my head? Can I breathe through the top of my head? Can I make my body feel cooler by spreading a feeling in a cool area of the body to the rest of the body? Can I make my body feel lighter by imagining it to be light? Can I make my body feel more comfortable by finding a comfortable spot in the body and letting it spread? And for all of this, this requires us to go back to this attitude of play, this attitude before we learned that there were these boundaries, these things that are possible and impossible. And we have to try to change our minds about what those boundaries are. So when we do this, we find a variety of ways to approach meditation practice. It doesn't necessarily have to be just sitting down, in, out, in, out, in, out. What's going on? There was a famous teacher named Ajahn Lee, and somebody once went to him and complained and said, "I'm doing all this meditation, and it's just in, out, in, out. What's the point of all it?" And Ajahn Lee's response was, "Well, if that's all that you see, that's all you get." In other words, there's a lot more going on here. But we have to learn to have this attitude of expanding our perception of what's possible in our meditation, using this attitude of imagination. When we have this attitude, we learn to play, then we learn to overcome the problems that arise in our meditation. We feel pains in our body from sitting a long time. How do we play to eliminate them? What can we do? Can we make our mind really, really small, like an acupuncture point, and put it into the most painful part of the body? Will that release it? Yeah. Can we compare the pain in our body and compare it to our mind and see if there's any pain in our mind, or is it just in our body? Is there a part of our body where it's not painful? Can we let our minds rest there? Is that possible? So when we start to test these things out this way, when we start to push the boundaries of our meditation a bit, start to push the boundaries that we think are possible a bit, then we learn about new possibilities, new solutions. We become somebody who's gaining a skill. And this is the same thing with these kids when they play, you know. When we sit down to meditate, won't always be perfect. Won't always be the best meditation. Every breath won't necessarily be the most satisfying. Sometimes it might seem boring. Yeah? And so we have to, again, develop a skill. Is it boring because I'm doing it wrong? Or is this just an area where nothing exciting is happening and my mind is looking for some kind of food outside, you know? So I've got to just bear with the boredom. So there's a lot to learn right here. There's a lot to learn with the breath at the tip of our nose. There's a lot to learn with the breath coursing through our body. There's a lot to learn spreading metta. There's a lot to learn right here in the mind. Because these things in our mind, these things that happen, the mind states that arise, the mind states that pass away, the happiness that arises, the happiness that passes away, the sadness that arises, the sadness that passes away, there's causes and conditions behind all of these things. And those causes and conditions are things that, to a certain extent, we can learn to manipulate. We can learn to become skilled in. Now, there is a purpose to this play. It isn't just to have pleasant feelings in our mind that we can just grab onto and eat. You know, like a kid who plays a bit and then their parents come and give them an ice cream cone and they just, you know, gobble it up and then the ice cream cone is gone. It's all over their face. Or there is a purpose to this. There's a higher purpose to this. You might even say there's an ambition to this. So the ambition is this. That is there a way that I can permanently stop my mind from suffering? Now that takes a real stretch of the imagination. Yeah? Often again, being raised in the West, we have this idea, as far as happiness goes, that's as far as sensual pleasures go. In other words, the things that we can taste, the things that we can see, the things that we can touch, the things that we can smell, things that we can hear, things that we can think. This is as far as happiness goes. There's no happiness beyond that. So meditation actually has possibilities. The possibilities the Buddha teaches us is that there are levels of happiness that lie even beyond this, beyond sensual pleasures, that come from training the mind itself, training the mind to be calm, calmer and calmer, calmer and calmer. How calm can I make my mind? How peaceful can I make my mind? And how can I make it peaceful? And when we train our minds in this way, we can find new possibilities for happiness that we didn't know existed before. Feelings that we didn't know existed before. Actually, I was staying at a monastery in California once, and this woman came with her husband and her son. And she was very, very upset. So there was this Q&A period where the senior monk would go around and ask everybody, all the lay people there, questions. Do you have any questions? 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 And he would do that every day at 4 o'clock. And so he was going around and all the monks would sit in the back and listen. And we saw this woman there with her son and her husband. And so, you know, maybe some were curious to hear what she would say. And what she said was, you know, last time I was, she said a mother's love for her son or for her children and for her husband, for her children is supposed to be unconditional. But I had this experience the last time I was at the monastery of unconditional love that completely dwarfs anything that I felt for my child or for my husband. And she was very upset about that, because this feeling that she'd experienced was much greater than anything she'd experienced before. And so the senior monk's answer to that was, well, you know, there's types of happiness, I'm paraphrasing here, in the mind that go beyond our normal types of happiness. But this is something that comes from developing a skill through practice. The cultivation of these types of happiness is a skill. And when we have these types of happiness for ourselves, then we have a refuge that goes a little bit further than sensuality, a little bit further than the things that we see, the things that we hear, the things that we smell, and forms a basis for us to have insight. So we can really start to question, with all these things arising and passing away, is there something that doesn't arise, doesn't pass away? Is there something safe? And it's through this cultivation of dispassion, through this cultivation of insight, that we can actually have experiences of cutting. We can actually penetrate the Buddha's teachings. So all these things start from something small. They start from learning to play. Yeah? Start from sitting down and asking ourselves questions about possibilities. Can I spread this feeling of coolness through my body? Yeah? Things like this. Yeah? Can I breathe from the back of my neck? Can I breathe from the bottom of my feet? Can I breathe through every pore in the body? Yeah? They start through potentials like this, and they build to higher states of happiness, higher states of pleasant feeling that we haven't experienced before. And ultimately, of course, the end of the Buddhist aim is to find a happiness that's totally unconditioned and that we don't have to maintain at all. Okay? So I think I'll leave that for your reflection. And everybody wish for me that I get out of Facebook jail.
It's like that Monopoly game, right? They have like the get out of jail card. Can you send one of those on Facebook? Okay, so I'll leave that there tonight.